Welcome. This is Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, an online Bible study with Dr. Joel S. Baden.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yale Bible Study on Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy with Dr. Joel Baden. The Yale Bible Study is a program of the Center for Continuing Education at Yale Divinity School, and I'm the managing director of the center, Kelly Morrissey. The Yale Bible Study website currently features 26 free Bible studies created by YDS faculty, as well as other helpful resources to help you with your studies or with preparing for sermons or about anything you can think of. These are all available for free on the website at yalebiblestudy.org. You can also find recordings of our previous online studies with Professors Baden, Collins, Attridge, and Hilton, as well as our lectionary podcast, Chapter, Verse, and Season, where you'll find two YDS faculty members discussing one of the appointed texts for each week. You can find the podcast on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other programs and offerings of the Center for Continuing Education, and I'll drop a link to our site in the chat later. Please remain muted throughout the session. There'll be a time of Q&A at the end of Joel's presentation, so please just drop your questions for him into the chat. Dr. Joel Baden is professor of Hebrew Bible and the director of the Center for Continuing Education. Professor Baden works widely in the field of Hebrew Bible, with special attention to the literary history of the Pentateuch, and is author of many books, scholarly articles, and popular essays. I'll provide a link to his bio in the chat if you'd like to learn more about his work. And now, without further ado, Dr. Joel Baden.
Thank you, Kelly. A big initial thanks to Kelly for all of the amazing work she does in making this possible. The Center for Continuing Education literally would not run or probably exist without her. So I want to make sure that she gets all the credit for making all of this happen. I want to say thank you to all of you for being here. Amazing how many people can muster up interest in what is probably some of the driest and most difficult texts of the Bible. Very cool to see everyone here. Nice to see lots of familiar faces from previous sessions, from previous teaching, from the internet, from all over. It's great to have everybody here. So we're going to be spending the next few weeks looking at Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, in which not that much happens, but in which there are a ton of really interesting texts, and it's actually enormously important material. It's just doesn't have quite the sort of cultural cachet as a Genesis or an Exodus. So what I'm going to try and do over these next 6 weeks is make this material as interesting and relevant and sort of user-friendly for you as I can, so that this doesn't become like the flyover states of the Bible. Okay, and we're going to start with Leviticus, which we're doing in two parts. The first part today, Leviticus 1 through 16, and then we'll do the second half next time. When you talk about Leviticus, I mean, honestly, who reads this stuff? I don't even know that it's readable. Like, it's not a nice story. How does one even sit down and go about attacking this material? One page in and people's eyes glaze over, and I don't blame them. But mostly the issue here is not so much that the text is boring, though it may be, but really the problem here is that we don't understand the literary genre that we're reading, because in contemporary times we don't really have the literary genre of ritual sacrificial instructions, at least not like this. And so when I talk about genre, what that means is we're simply not accustomed to understanding this kind of text. We don't see it very much. But there are texts in our world that are similar. So the example I think of is if I were asked to pick up and read like a legal decision, like a court decision or a legal brief, with all of its references and citations, I wouldn't know what I was really looking at. Lord knows if somebody asked me to pick up like a medical text or God forbid math, right? I wouldn't really know what I was looking at. because I'm simply not familiar with that genre of literature. For many people out there, you know, you flip to the sports pages and you look at box scores and recaps of sporting events, and it's my, you know, sort of mumbo jumbo without the framework. We don't have access really to the literary genre of ritual sacrificial texts anymore, which means for the lay reader who's not trained in reading these things, it becomes and feels almost unreadable. But we have to remember that in ancient Israel, that was a world that was suffused with animal sacrifice, right? They not only probably understood the literary genre for those who were literate, but also like they knew what sacrifices were about. They knew what they looked like. They knew how they functioned and what they did in a way that we really have no access to, except through sort of our critical reading of the text. Leviticus is full of so many details, a million details, you know, how you get the blood, where you get the blood, what you do with the different parts of the animal, who does what, when, where. Tons of details, all of which matter, but we're not going to get into the details. Right? We're interested in the big picture. What do all of the details add up to? Right? Most readers don't even understand the basic structure or the framework of Leviticus and the rituals, much less the details of how they each operate. So similarly, right, you could probably teach me to read a legal decision so that I understood, right, the details of that particular case. But what I really want to know is how the legal system works. You could read a box score and you could figure out exactly how that game went. But what I want to know is, how is the game even played, right? What is the game itself? So we're not going to go into the details so that we figure out how any given ritual or sacrifice worked. I want to know how the system works. And what's being presented to us in Leviticus is more than just details of sacrificial rituals. What we're being given here is actually an entire theology, a nearly complete understanding of God and God's relationship with Israel, with us. And I think it's actually spanning the many, many chapters that does. I think this is actually the fullest sort of coherent theological statement in the entire Bible. And despite the fact that it's presented to us in a genre that is super foreign to us and difficult for us to read, what's going on under there is in fact incredibly relevant. And that's what I'm going to try and show today. So let's start with, as we always should, where we are in the story. This is a depiction of the tabernacle, which is the structure that was just built at the end of the book of Exodus. And we're not turning to something new when we get to Leviticus. We are picking up directly from the construction of the tabernacle and the climax of the end of Exodus, which is God coming down and dwelling in this structure. And when I say we're like not starting something new, I really mean it. Leviticus actually, I think, picks up mid-sentence from the end of Exodus. So we're like right in the same thing. God has just come down, dwelt, taken up residence in this tabernacle, which, you know, means that the tabernacle is God's home. God is literally dwelling in it. And for us as contemporary readers, it will be helpful over the course of this this session and probably future ones as well, good to remember that the metaphor of the divine home is going to be really useful for understanding everything that's going on here. So I want us to keep in mind all throughout the idea that everything we're talking about has to do with God's home. But I also want to be clear that when what I said metaphor, it's a metaphor for us, because that's, you know, we don't think of God as literally dwelling in a home. But for them, it wasn't a metaphor. For them, God literally physically took up residence in this space. And that is partly why it's so important. In fact, for the text, in the world of the text, this is potentially the most important material in maybe the entire Hebrew Bible. And how do I know that? Because I'm employing what I think of as sort of this golden ratio of text to time. which is to say, from Leviticus 1 through Numbers 10, which is when Israel departs from Sinai, is a 1.5 entire books of the Bible. 1.5 books, but it only covers 50 days of time within the narrative itself. Now think about this, from Genesis 1 through Exodus 40, that's thousands and thousands of years of narrative time. And here we've got 50 days in a whole book and a half. That's where the text slows down. That's where the text is saying, this is important, pay attention. I am going to now share my screen because I see that I should be doing that. There it is. So there's the tabernacle. This is the house, right? This is God's home. And this is where all of the, everything that happens in Leviticus takes place from this space. God, Moses has come down from Mount Sinai, has built this dwelling, and now all communication between God and Moses, between God and Aaron, between God and Israel, comes from here, because this is where God is literally dwelling. So here, it's in the building of this, the tabernacle, this is where the time slows down, and this is where the text really starts giving us all of this incredible detail. And that's not surprising. If you had to care for God's house, if God were living among you in this literal dwelling place, I think you'd want to know in pretty close detail how to take care of it also. So that's the mind frame we need to be in. So now let's get into the sacrifices themselves, because the sacrifices are in fact how you care for God's house. There are two different kinds of sacrifices in Leviticus. There are free will sacrifices, and there are not free will sacrifices. So I want to begin with looking at the free will sacrifices. The idea being here, okay, so you want to bring God a present, like a housewarming gift. Here's how you do it. Now, within these free will offerings, you just kind of want to bring him something. There are two subcategories. There are whole offerings, right? Whole burnt offerings, sometimes called Holocaust offerings, where the entire animal is burned on the altar. And there are things that are called well-being offerings, sometimes called peace offerings. And in these, part of the animal is burned, part of the animal is given to and eaten by the priests who perform the ritual, and part of it is returned to the person who offered the sacrifice for them to eat. All of these, both the burnt offerings and the well-being offerings, are really expressions of love for the deity and thanks and hope, whatever else. The main point is that they are, for the most part, not required, right? This is why free will. So you can bring these anytime you want to. And the text simply tells you how to do so when you do feel like doing that. I want to stop here a second to note that these types of sacrifices, the whole burnt offering, the grain offering, which is a subset of the whole burnt offering, and the well-being offering, these sacrifices are known everywhere in the Bible. There's reference all the time to people offering whole burnt offerings or offering these well-being offerings. These are ubiquitous throughout the Bible. It doesn't matter who the author is, doesn't matter what the text is, doesn't matter when it's from. Everybody knows about these. But the sacrifices that follow, the ones I'm about to get to, that is the not free will ones, those sacrifices are known only to Leviticus and the texts directly related to it. So that's, I want to just pause to keep as a reminder that what we have here in Leviticus isn't reflective of actual practice in ancient Israel. It's certainly not at the time that it was written. What we have here is a utopian text written by priests, right? And one that expresses the specific values of this like priestly social subset, right? Which isn't to say it's not important, right? It's in our Bible, it's a biblical text. It has as much weight as any other, but historically, the ritual system we see here in Leviticus was not universally ancient Israelite. Most ancient Israelites would have no idea about basically any of this. With that caveat in mind, I want to turn to the required sacrifices. Okay, so you screwed up somehow. The first category of these are usually called sin offerings. You've inadvertently transgressed some prohibition. And inadvertently is important, right? You didn't know something wasn't allowed, and then you found out it wasn't allowed. Oh man, what a silly mistake I made. The example I use all the time is like, you didn't know that you couldn't, go trim your flowers on the Sabbath, right? And then someone's like, you can't do that. And you're like, oh man, I had no idea. Or you did know you couldn't trim your flowers on the Sabbath, but you forgot which day it was, right? Same thing, right? Oops, like you knew better, but you didn't realize it. You just made a mistake, unwitting errors, inadvertent transgressions. So you've got that category. And then you've got what are in the second one here, a trespass. What this means is you've intentionally or unintentionally trespassed against the sacred sphere, right? You've done something inappropriate within the sanctuary. Like you went and you grabbed something that you're not supposed to touch. Or maybe you falsely swore using God's name, right? Which is also a sacred item in the mind of the Bible. But anyway, for these, you also need to bring what's called a reparation offering as a type of sacrifice, and then you with a little payment added on top. For the most part, we're talking here about unintentional sins, right? Stuff that you didn't mean to do, or at the very least, you did, and then you felt bad about afterward. So we have the categories, free will offerings and required offerings for unintentional sins. After this, we get this whole list of the detailed ritual procedures for all the various sacrifices, for burnt offerings and grain offerings and sin offerings and guilt offerings and well-being offerings, right? Each of which has its own rituals and its own practices. The key for all of the required sacrifices is that all of these violations require, and all of the sacrifices that we have laid out for us provide, this thing that is usually translated as expiation or atonement. And this is a word obviously that we see in here all the time, right? The sacrifice that atones for the sin. So the real question that we have to get to here first, like one of the big novelties of the critical academic study of this material, is the definition of the word atonement. Because atonement in Leviticus, in these chapters, is not what we mean by atonement today. So what is atonement? In a very practical sense, atonement is the application of sacrificial blood to the sanctuary. That is, you kill the animal and you collect its blood, and then the priests literally place the blood of the animal onto the physical form of the sanctuary. They put it on the altar, or they put it on the on different spaces in the sanctuary. That is the thing that creates atonement, and that feels weird to us. But their understanding, at least in these chapters, their understanding is that blood acts as what we in the business call ritual detergent, right? The blood cleanses the sanctuary. And this is why, by the way, you're also not allowed to consume blood in this system of thought, because the blood, animal blood, has a divine purpose, right? It's like you, the same way that you don't want to eat detergent. So practically, blood is atonement is applying blood to the sanctuary. Theoretically, conceptually, atonement is the means by which the divine dwelling, the tabernacle, is ritually purged of contamination that has accumulated there. That's why I call it detergent, right? It's cleaning. It's cleaning off contamination. So what is contaminating the sanctuary? Acts of wrongdoing, so sins, and impurities, which we'll get to in a little bit. This contamination accumulates in the sanctuary. And if it's allowed to collect and collect and collect, it could drive the deity out, right? Thereby threatening the community as a whole, right? Too much dirt in God's house, God leaves God's house. And so you're thinking again, like, oh, I get it. Like, is sin as metaphorical dirt? That makes sense. But again, I want to be clear, for them, not a metaphor. Like, it's a real thing, a real, almost tangible, if invisible thing, this sin that accumulates in the sanctuary. So given all this, atonement, at least for our contemporary use of the word, atonement's a bad translation for what's going on here. What's actually happening here is purgation or purification. And I want to be clear about when somebody offers one of these sacrifices, who or what it is that's being cleansed of the sin. It's not the offerer. When I go in the Levitical system, if I say, oh man, I cut my flowers on the Sabbath, I need to, you know, do this offering to make up for it. When I do the offering, I'm not the one being cleansed. I don't have sin on me. That's not how it works. The sin, in fact, is on the sanctuary. It's on the sacred spaces that belong to God. And the blood that is applied, the blood of my sacrifice, is applied to clean that sin off. Which is why, in fact, sin offering, which you'll see in many, many translations of the Bible, sin offering is not a great translation either. It's a purification offering. Right? We're capturing what it is that the sacrifice actually is doing. It's actually purifying where the blood is touching. In other words, in the system, people are required to sacrifice in order to maintain the cleanliness of the deity's house. You have to understand, they saw this as a system that worked. Service and maintenance. This is not mystical or esoteric, but this is entirely functional. And all of this text that we're in the middle of, everything from Exodus 25 on, centers around this divine dwelling place, the tabernacle. Right? We had in Exodus 25 through 40, its construction and God dwelling in it. And in the sacrificial system, in the first half of Leviticus, we get how to maintain it. And why? Like, what's at stake? So again, sins are dirt, or even better, perhaps, it's like mold. Too much of it in your house, and you just can't live there anymore. Which is bad for you when it's your house, but bad for everyone when it's God and God's house. God's presence in the midst of Israel is protective and sustaining. God's absence is unthinkable. Keeping God's house clean isn't just a nice thing to do, it's necessary. It's necessary. So we get the tabernacle built, we get the sacrifices laid out in detail, and then we get to who's doing the sacrifices, which is the priests. And so in Leviticus 8, we get the consecration of Aaron and his sons to serve as priests. And after the consecration, once we have the priests in place to actually like do the sacrifices that I just learned all about, we get the actual sacrifices themselves, right? Where Moses says to Aaron, okay, come forward to the altar and sacrifice your offerings, right? And, you know, do all of the things, right? This is, we're preparing for the appearance of God to the people. And the presence of the Lord appears to all the people in the entrance of the tabernacle. And fire comes from within the tabernacle and ignites the altar and consumes the sacrifices that are on it. And this is like the climax of everything that's happened since Israel arrived at Sinai, right? When they got, and here's this sort of sequence of things. First, God appeared on top of Sinai. They built the tabernacle, and then God comes down into the tabernacle. And finally, we get the beginning of proper sacrificial worship when the fire consumes the first offering. Now, a brief aside, is sacrifice about feeding the deity? Not explicitly, but you might note that in this moment, the fire does consume, literally the verb is eat, the sacrifices. So somewhere in the back of some mind somewhere, I think, is probably a notion of the sacrifices being food for the deity. But I don't know, they're not really how they're thinking anymore. After the revelation of the deity and after the beginning of sacrifice proper, like the first thing that happens is transgression, the deaths of Aaron's two eldest sons, Nadav and Avihu. And this like famous little episode where they offer, you know, strange fire. They put incense in their fire pans and they bring it before God, and fire comes forth from the Lord, just like he did a second ago to consume the sacrifices. But in this case, it consumes them, right? Consumes Aaron's sons. What did they actually do wrong here? Is, I think, a question that most people have upon reading this. But I would posit that the better question is actually, what did they do right? Let's see. They prepared an incense offering with their own kindling when no incense offering was ordered. We already learned, right? Here's when you bring sacrifices. There's no place for just bring an incense offering for funsies. So they brought an unprescribed, undesired sacrifice. You know, if a sacrifice is prescribed, it's legitimate. Otherwise, it's what we would call sacrilege. Not only did they go too far in their attempt at piety, right? God intended, as we saw a chapter ago, that the divine fire would light sacrifices. And here they are lighting the fire themselves, taking on the divine prerogative. And they're doing this all on their own behalf, when we should be clear that the priestly role is one of public service in ancient Israel. It's public, so everything that priest does is on behalf of the community. And here are Nadav and Avihu sort of taking advantage of their roles as close mediators of the divine, but not for private gain rather than for public good. What's the basic issue here with the Nadav and Avihu story? It's that ritual has to be followed precisely. I mean, we just got all of these detailed rules. And also, it's a reminder that ritual crimes are serious stuff. This is not just technicalities. What looks like mind-numbing detail to us is, in fact, incredibly important. The divine presence in the tabernacle depends upon proper worship. And the first thing we do is learn that lesson in this incredibly dramatic way. We then move on back to a set of laws. And we get the kosher laws. I am not in this moment going to go into the rationale, real or imagined, behind the kosher laws. Again, I'm trying to think of it within this larger Levitical system. How does this make sense? According to Genesis 1, all meat and vegetation was given to humans for food at creation. And humans were forbidden only in the time of the flood to consume the blood of an animal. Right? That's where we are. Suddenly now we're getting new restrictions, which are exclusively for Israelites. And these restrictions cover the entirety of the animal kingdom, just as it was described categorically in Genesis 1. Right? So you have land animals and water animals and birds and swarming things. But these are all of the animals that were created in the beginning, in creation. And each category here is divided into the clean animals and the unclean animals. Which is to say, here we have Israel being told how to maintain dietary restrictions that correspond to the divisions of the natural world from Genesis 1, which is, in fact, just the same way that with the Sabbath, right, with Israel's rules about not working on the Sabbath, they're maintaining a temporal behavior that corresponds to the natural divisions of time established in Genesis 1. In this way, Israel is sort of kept separate from the rest of humanity. Everybody understands the same divisions, but they have take on a special meaning and role within the life of Israel. When we get into the kosher laws in Leviticus 11 and chapters 11 through 15, we're no longer dealing with sins as we were earlier. We're now dealing with impurity. And I want to take a moment here to distinguish between these two complementary dualities: sacred and profane, and pure and impure. and I want to make sure that we are able to keep these separate because this is important. Sacred is the word for those things that have to do with God. If it has to do with God, it's sacred. Everything else is profane. Right, so sacrifices are sacred. Priests are sacred. The sanctuary is sacred. The things in the sanctuary are sacred. God's name is sacred. I'm not sacred. You're not sacred. My computer's not sacred, right? Those things are all profane. Unless I were to dedicate my computer to the sanctuary, at which point it would become sacred because it would now belong to God. So sacred is the things having to do with God. Everything else is profane. And for the most part, these are unchangeable. A sacred thing, once sacred, is always sacred. And a profane thing, unless you dedicate it to the sanctuary or to God, is always profane. Pure and impure, however, are mutable. An item, a person, an animal, a vessel, a piece of clothing, a house, an item can change states from pure to impure and back again, and do so constantly. And the danger in the whole system is that the sacred becomes tinged with the impure. That's the like crossing that we're trying to avoid. Right? A profane thing can be pure or impure. A sacred thing can and should be pure. Sacred and impure is the combination that doesn't work. Okay, that's fine. What's impurity, Baden? Well, how to say this so that it makes some sense? Impurity is an invisible, though very real, coating. It pollutes everything it touches, and it communicates degrees of impurity. If something is very, very impure and I touch it, I get some impurity on me. I'm impure now. Impurity is not like dirt. It's not like an infection. And it's not evil or demonic somehow. Impurity is a fact of life. Certain things are just naturally sources of impurity. There's no sense of moral condemnation attached to it. There's nothing sinful, there's nothing evil about impurity. Basic life events, sex, childbirth, burial, cause impurity. These aren't bad things. In fact, these are things that are required and holy almost, right? These are beautiful, required, blessed events. And yet they cause impurity. One of the things that people often don't understand is there is no prohibition against becoming impure. People were constantly becoming impure. Most people were impure most of the day. Being impure is totally fine. Remaining impure, however, allows that impurity to slowly make its way to the sanctuary. Impurity, like sin, is drawn magnetically to the sanctuary, and it accumulates there. It's why the only people who really need to actively avoid impurity are priests, right? Because they're in the sanctuary, they're like super close. Everyone else in Israel, they don't have to avoid impurity. You just have to make sure to get rid of impurities when you get them. So what is it that causes impurity? This is what Leviticus 11 through 15 is all about. What causes impurity? So, things that represent the escape of life forces, corpses, animal carcasses, the effluence of life fluids, semen, menstrual fluid, childbirth, blood, other genital discharges, certain diseases. You'll note that human waste is not impure because it has nothing to do with the escape of life forces. And regular blood is also not impure, probably because it is, as we saw already, like it's ritual detergent, right? Blood has a sacred function, though not human blood. So that's what causes impurity. What gets rid of impurity? For the most part, passage of time and cleansing, usually just in water, right? That's what purifies you. In other words, minor impurities, which is most of them, minor impurities are gotten rid of by taking a bath, washing your clothes, and sleeping it off, right? That's it, right? If you take a bath and you wash your clothes, your impurity goes away all on its own. Easy, right? And again, impurities are only a problem if you neglect to purify yourself, right? Then they start traveling. That's minor impurities. Major impurities, like the really bad ones, those actually directly contaminate the tabernacle, like sin, like unintentional sin. And anytime the sanctuary is contaminated and defiled, you need to offer the sacrifice that cleans it, right? That purification sacrifice. So again, what we're talking about here, even when we're talking about human impurity, what we're talking about is keeping the sanctuary clean, right? The divine dwelling place is the focus of the laws. A brief aside, impurity laws, as you can tell, encourage hygiene, right? Everybody should be taking a bath and washing their clothes at the end of every day, which is terrific. What a lovely side effect. Terrific, except when, for various social reasons, it's not. As it turned out, right, in Europe during the Black Death in the Middle Ages, Jews who were following their ritual impurity practices were distinctively less affected by the Black Death than the less hygienically minded Christians around them. Great for the Jews, except the Christians then assumed that because Jews weren't dying, they must be behind it, and slaughtered thousands and thousands of Jews as reprisal for this disease that Jews were avoiding just by taking their baths. That's my history lesson about that. Okay. We're getting to the climax now, to the end, the pinnacle of this whole system, which is contained in Leviticus 16, which is like one of my favoriteest chapters in the entirety of the Bible. It's the conceptual climax of the entire ritual system, what's known to us as the Day of Atonement, or remembering our better translation, not the Day of Atonement, but the Day of Purgation. Or purification. Over the course of a year, contamination accumulates in the sanctuary. You might ask, but how is it accumulating, right? If people are all offering the right sacrifices, shouldn't the contamination be constantly cleaned up? And yes, in a very, very perfect world, that would be true. But remember, all the sacrifices we've seen are for unintentional sins. You accidentally did something wrong, and then you realized it, and so you brought your sacrifice to clean up the mess. But what if you never realized you did something wrong? You didn't realize it, you didn't bring the sacrifice because you didn't know to, but your sin is there still, contaminating the sanctum. When you became impure, you offered the proper sacrifice, but what if you didn't realize that you had become impure? You know, what if you unknowingly touched something that transmitted impurity to you, and you just sat there with it, and like it never went anywhere? That impurity is just sitting there in the tabernacle, just getting dirtier and dirtier. The system in Leviticus assumes that people are in fact sacrificing when they know to, but it also recognizes that there's the real possibility of them not knowing to. So yes, unintentional sins and unrecognized impurities are accumulating constantly in the sanctuary. And then there's this category we haven't even discussed yet, which is intentional sins. Deliberate crimes, don't like slowly make their way in like mold. Deliberate crimes contaminate the very inner sanctum of the divine dwelling place, the heart of the sanctuary, the heart of God's home, right? The Holy of Holies, right? Where the ark is. Right? Deliberate crimes like zoom directly to there without passing go. And that area is not cleaned by the usual methods. The normal ritual detergent of sacrificial blood isn't strong enough to clean those stains. Those sins. So once a year, the whole sanctuary, along with its innermost chamber, has to be cleaned. And here's how that happens. First, Aaron has to offer a bull for a sin offering, right? A purification offering for himself and for his family. Right? in case he's accidentally done anything wrong, right? So because the priest has to be in good standing before he can undertake the ceremony for everyone else. Then Aaron sacrifices a goat as the sin or purification offering on behalf of the Israelites. And in these sacrifices, the two of them, Aaron creates a cloud of incense in front of the ark. He's going into the Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber. He's going in there with this incense. Why? Because God is literally in there. And the one time that Aaron goes in, he has to make sure he doesn't see anything, right? So he's creating this cloud of smoke to block his view of the ark. And then he sprinkles the blood of the sacrifice in and around that area, this most sacred, like the inner bedchamber of the deity, right? And the one that, you know, obviously, if it's dirty in there, God is leaving. It's so incredibly important to get in there. You know, it's like the like that very deep spring cleaning where you just got to get under every nook and cranny, right? You got to get the blood into that inner chamber on this one day of all days. And by doing these things, right, the shrine, the tabernacle, is purged of the uncleanness, that is the impurity, and the sins, right, unintentional, of the Israelites. Having done so, Aaron goes out there and does the same thing and purges the altar, you know, outside where the animals are all sacrificed, right? We're doing the basic spring cleaning, but as a good cleaning does, you move from the inside out, right? Like you're sweeping the dirt outward. And now for the part that is most famous. Aaron lays his hands on a live goat and transfers Israel's sins onto it. What does he transfer? Their iniquities, not their impurities, right? We already cleaned up the impurities. The blood does that, right? This is their deliberate sins, right? Which can't be destroyed, right? You can't detergent them out of existence. They can only be like physically removed. And they're removed by this laying on of hands of Aaron onto this goat. And this, of course, is where we get the scapegoat from. It's the goat that carries the sins away. And the goat is sent out to Azazel. I don't have this up on the screen, but it's sent out, the text says, to Azazel, which is a word that means fierce God. What the hell is an Azazel? Azazel is evidently a demon that lives in the wilderness. And the sins of the people are thereby sent off beyond civilization to the wilderness gods. And they become the property and really the problem of some non-Israelite divine being. Are you bothered by the idea that there's a non-Israelite divine being out there in the wilderness? You very well may be, but the Bible isn't. And finally, Aaron offers a new set of burnt offerings for himself and for the people, thereby sort of restoring and renewing the sacrificial practice. This day, this amazing day, represents individual and communal catharsis of a sort, right? The sins and the impurities of the Israelites are removed, equilibrium with the deity and his dwelling place are restored. This extraordinary ritual day, what of course becomes in Judaism Yom Kippur, is in fact a ritual reset button. It brings the tabernacle and God's relationship with Israel back to their original factory settings. If it weren't for this exceptional ritual, sins and impurities would simply accumulate and brazen sins would contaminate. And God would have no choice after enough time but to leave his home with, you know, devastating consequences. I want to step back for just a couple of minutes, not even, before I get to your questions. And I want to think about what all of this means in the big picture. Right? All of these sacrifices and sins and impurities and rituals, what is it all about? We've seen, I hope, that the purpose of all of this ritual is to maintain the cleanliness of God's home. And we've also seen that God's presence in the midst of Israel is affected by almost everything the Israelites do. Obviously their ritual acts and their sins, but also what and how they eat, sex, death, sickness, In this system, every action is made more meaningful. Every individual's actions are part of this larger drama unfolding in the world, right? Of God's dwelling place and the maintenance of it. And every individual, therefore, has a responsibility to ensure that they are doing their part in this drama. You make a mess, you clean up the mess. You sin, you clean up the sin. But, and I think this is my favorite part of the whole thing, when you're offering these sacrifices, you're doing it not for your own sake, but for the sake of the community. The entire sacrificial system in these chapters of Leviticus doesn't really care about you. Not for your own sake. You, the individual, I'm sure are lovely, but it's not really about you. Your sins didn't make you a bad person. Your impurities aren't evil. Honestly, none of this, right? Unintentional sins and impurities, none of it's a big deal. Like, no one's really that interested. You know, well, my kids drop food on the floor by accident, and like, it's not a big deal. I just clean it up. But of course, you know, they leave it on the floor. Now we have problems. Same basic idea, right? Your job in the system is to not intentionally sin, obviously, and to clean up after your unintentional messes, and you know, take a bath every day. It's also like my kids. To do all of this, right, to offer these sacrifices, to participate in the system, doesn't give you an eternal reward of some sort. There is no prize for you to do all this. You do it because everyone else is doing it. You do it because collectively, you're working toward the same fundamentally communal goal. This system is so hard to read and so generically distant from us and so dense and so obscure and so foreign and distant. This system is actually all about the individual acting on behalf of the community. It's about everyone doing their small part for the collective good. And it's true, the way that this idea is expressed in the text may to us be boring or difficult, and God knows it's foreign. But the idea, the system, is not only, I think, comprehensible, I think it's inspired and inspiring. And I think despite the difficulty of reading it, it's actually far more relevant than it seems. Okay, that's my part. Now it's time for me to see what is going on in the questions. And let me get up to where we were. That's where everybody says, hello, hello, hello. So I'm going to start at the top of the questions to see how many I can get through and keep adding them if you keep having them. Question, we've got Leviticus 16 is this origin text for Yom Kippur, which is something I said. Can we know whether the priests and congregation follow the ritual instructions as laid out in Leviticus 1 through 16? I think the question here is, were they actually doing this stuff? And again, I think we have to distinguish between who we're asking about. I think that the people who wrote this, the priests responsible for this, I'm sure really wanted everyone in Israel to be doing this. And perhaps they themselves were in their, you know, in the sanctuaries, in the temples where they were practicing this. I don't think that's the same thing as saying every priest and everybody, and certainly, you know, within the world of the story, yeah, they were, but in reality, probably not. What else? Where the purification rituals already performed, and this is this is a question of were purification rituals like a thing that was out there, and this text is reimagining them into something new, a new system. Or are these totally different from the surrounding culture? All I can say about this is these purification rituals, these required priestly sacrifices, these offerings, this whole system is nowhere represented anywhere outside of like the priestly texts of the Bible. So if it was a known thing, no one else talked about it in the way that they all talk about, like, oh, I have to go and I'm going to go make an offering. I'm going to go, you know, sacrifice a whole offering to God because a thank you for this. Or I'm going to go, like, let's go have a party and we'll eat some meat. So I don't know that it existed anywhere outside of this system. My guess is not, in part because this is so patently a system that is, oh, you unintentionally did something wrong, you got to bring a sacrifice to the temple. It's a system that so obviously benefits the priests that my guess is, my strong suspicion is this is a system that was invented by the priests responsible for this text, essentially as a money-making venture, maybe. Question of what does holiness mean? Holiness is the same thing as what I described as sacred, right? If something is holy, there aren't distinctive words in Hebrew. Holy and sacred are the same word, and sanctify, right? That's all one word. That's the stuff that conceptually belongs to the realm of the deity somehow. Yes, all of these rituals are part of respecting, I think, sacred space and making sure that the sacred doesn't become contaminated in bad ways. Kelly asks, though I bet that this was somebody who asked Kelly it and she's just transmitting it, is the tent of meeting and the tabernacle the same thing? And the answer is basically yes. Within the priestly world, the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, the sanctuary, the divine dwelling place are all words for basically the same thing. Would sacrifices be part of the transition to monotheism? No. I kind of want to stop there, but I won't. Sacrifices are offered in all of the ancient world, monotheistic, polytheistic. I've said in other cases, right? Israel was not really monotheistic at this point. They simply thought of all the gods in the universe, the one we should be offering sacrifices to and worshiping is this one, right? Is our God, naturally. And basically everybody else thought the same thing. So their sacrifices are offered to their God, but that doesn't say anything about their understanding of other deities elsewhere in the world. Was the blood that was, this is a great question, was the blood that was splashed on the sides of the altar ever cleaned off? Is there like a drain or something, or did the blood just sit there? It's a terrific question, one of the things we know is it doesn't rain a lot there. So it's not like, you know, even though the altar is outdoors, it's not like it's being constantly washed with rain. The Bible is not so clear on this, on any of those kinds of details. Later Jewish literature, literature that's largely found in what's called the Mishnah, which is this second century of the Common Era codification of Jewish laws and practice, we get their description, even though it's compiled after the destruction of the temple, we think there's probably some truth behind it. We get description there of exactly that, of drains and of regular cleaning and rotations to make sure that this is not simply like the grossest, smelliest place on earth, which you'd think would defeat the purpose of like keeping God's house clean. Someone simply wrote, Paula wrote, one author, Leviticus 1 through 16? And the answer is, for all intents and purposes, yes. This is one coherent system from one. Even if I don't want to use like author, this is essentially a literary unity, this block. Are there bits and pieces here and there that are maybe later or earlier? Yes, but the system is a coherent single one. Deanna Douglas asks in Hebrew, what about Reach Nichoach, which is to say, what that means is like the nice smell. What about the nice smell of the sacrifices? And my bet is that may have come up when I was talking about whether this is food for God or not. It is noteworthy that there are certain sacrifices that create a lovely smell for the deity and which seems to be very much appreciated. You know what's interesting? The required sacrifices don't. required sacrifices don't create a nice smell because they're not about doing something nice for God. They're about cleaning up. The free will offerings, those create a nice smell. Here's a question that I was asked. That's not quite about Leviticus. I'm gonna ask it, and I'll say why in a second. This may simply be a setup for me. Somebody asked, why is God suddenly bestowed with what's in Hebrew the kavod, right? Presence, or it's literally weight, but it's it's a particular sort of this holiness or separateness or special being. Why does it suddenly happen in Exodus 24 and not before that? Is this part of P's plot development? And there seems to be no way that this is a legit question, because one of the people who's in this room, Abby, is one of my former students who literally wrote me a paper on this. And I feel like this was just a means of getting Abby called out. Congratulations, Abby, you're the expert. So person who asked that question, find Abby afterwards and she'll tell you. Jumping ahead a little bit as I look through these questions, good one. Can any human dedicate themselves to God, becoming sacred? Therefore, can you volunteer yourself? And it's interesting because the answer is like yes, there are mechanisms, and we'll read them. I don't know if we'll talk about them, but they come up later in our readings for these sessions. You can dedicate a human to God, but you can't become a priest. Right? Priest is a hereditary position, only descendants of Aaron. So the really good question is, what does it mean to dedicate yourself to the sanctuary? What kind of service are you even permitted to do if you're not a priest and you're not a Levite? That is one of these, one of the sort of priestly assistants. I don't have a great answer for that. I really don't know. In theory, you could dedicate yourself, by which you mean dedicate your, which might mean dedicating like your net worth, your profits. But I don't. It's hard to actually imagine what it really means. Matt says, as a point of clarification, the group goal is that God stays with the group, and that's totally it. Right. And one of the reasons I think I find this so compelling theologically is because it's so obviously transferable to, contemporary situation. Even if we don't think God is dwelling in any particular building, the idea of the divine presence being on earth or being among us or being the thing around which the community is shaped and formed, and there being a individual responsibility for the collective maintenance of God's presence, however imagined, right? That I think is pretty readily transferable from this detailed sacrificial ritual to a more abstract metaphorical kind of thing. In this system, does sin or impurity impact God's blessing of you or your family? Nope, it's not about you, right? Your unintentional sin, it's truly, you, like, if my kid drops something on the floor, it doesn't affect my like love for them. I just need to clean it up. And if they don't, I start to get annoyed. And eventually maybe I leave the room. That's the idea there. It's really not about you and your inherent goodness in any way, shape, or form. Lots of people thinking about questions about like impurity, not being a sin, especially if impurity wasn't the sin, why was it considered impure and not something natural and acceptable? And this is my point, it is natural and acceptable. It is totally okay to be impure. The problem is that in the same way that sacredness, sanctity, holiness isn't natural, right? This impurity simply can't get in contact with the sacred. And if Israel, for the most part, if you were an Israelite and you were impure, the only thing you're not allowed to do is go into the sacred space. You can go about your life completely normally otherwise. You just can't go to the sacred space. But it's completely natural. Childbirth is natural, right? Burial is natural. Sex is natural. Disease is natural. Nothing about impurity has anything to do with the unnatural or the unacceptable. It's totally good. In the same way that being sick today, you know, if you're sick, you're not supposed to come to work, but nobody thinks less of you for it. It's just a thing that happened. And that's what really impurity is. I think that I am at time. Lots of questions here. We'll have time for more questions about Leviticus next week when we do the second half, which is a slightly different set of stuff, but builds on what we're doing here. So hopefully some of those questions will remain relevant as we move ahead.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 2.